When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Chapter 13 of Garibaldi and the Making of Italy by George Macaulay Trevelyan. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Battle of the Volturno, October 1st and 2nd. Pure as the archangel's cleaving darkness throw, the sword he sees, the keen unwearied sword, a single blade against a circling horde, an eye for freedom and the trampled few. The cry of liberty from dungeon cell, from exile was his God's command to smite. As for a swim in sea he joined the fight, with radiant face, full sure that he did well. Bold a warrior dealing mortal strokes, whose nature was a child's, amid his foes a wary trickster at the battle's close. No gentler friend this leopard dashed with fox. Down the long roll of history will run the story of these deeds, and speed his race beneath defeat more hotly to embrace the noble cause and trust to another son. George Meredith, The Century of Garibaldi. On the last day of September, by way of prelude to their coming attack, the Royalists kept up a heavy cannonade, and their infantry skirmished along the line of outposts in front of Capua. The hottest firing was at the ferries below San Giorgio Ridge, on which the Garibaldian batteries had been mounted only the day before. After sunset, all again fell silent. A mile to the south of the ferries, on the lowest slopes of Monte Tifata, stands the village of Sant'Angelo. Its church, built a dozen centuries ago out of the ruins of Roman villas and temples, was the center of Medici's position, filled that night with sleeping soldiers and on the morrow with the wounded and the dead. On the embanked terrace, in front of the church, stood Garibaldi, with his back to the darkened mountain, and his eyes fixed on the distant lights of Capua. Suddenly, far away in the middle of the enemy's lines, a tongue of flame leapt up and flared on the night sky. He watched it for some time in silence, and then turned round with a laugh. "Sir," he said, "we must not sleep too heavily tonight." The next moment he was on his horse, riding back to Caserta to arrange the last details with Bixio and with Tour. "He laughed, the old lion," said one of the group left up on the terrace. "That flame must be the signal for their attack." After midnight a heavy fog crept over the Capuan plain and wrapped itself round the Bourbon regiments as they issued one by one from the gate of the fortress. In the Volturno region, all the ground that does not rise to a certain level above the sea is composed of dark volcanic tufa, soft and easy to cut. All above that level is hard white limestone rock. The village of Sant'Angelo, on the lower slopes of the mountain, stands on the junction of the two strata and is built half of tufa and half of limestone. While Santa Maria and all the villages of the plain are built, like Naples itself, of the black spongy tufa, of which the soil is composed, architecturally a sordid stone of discouraging and criminal appearance. The highly cultivated plain between Capua and Monte Tifata is traversed by the peasants and their flocks by means of a network of lanes, sunk 10 feet deep in the soft tufa, and therefore invisible at more than a few yards' distance. The road that leads from Santa Maria to Sant'Angelo crosses by bridges over 4 or 5 of these hidden lanes, up some of which Bourbon columns penetrated before dawn on October 1st, and thus obtain unobserved a footing inside Garibaldi's line at its weakest point, the almost undefended space between Sant'Angelo and Santa Maria. Further to the south, the fog served to hide the approach of the other columns under Tabacci, who surprised and routed the defenders of the cemetery and of San Tommaso. Many of these first runaways fled by the high road to Naples and arrived there before noon, spreading panic like the first comers from Waterloo in the Belgian capital. D'Aiella, who commanded the National Guard, called out the whole force and patrolled Naples and the neighbouring villages to prevent a reactionary movement. Knowing the impressionable character of the Neapolitans, D'Aiella sent out premature and exaggerated reports of victory to counteract the tales of the runaways. Meanwhile, Tabacci's men seized the railway embankment and a large group of buildings called St. Agostino, whence they enfiladed the trenches in front of Santa Maria with cannon and rifle fire. Fortunately, since Garibaldi had come out by an early train from Caserta and was already at Milbit's side, Santa Maria itself was vigorously defended. Under the Roman archway at its entrance to cannon, destined to be worked that day by many successive relays of professional and volunteer gunners, began their 10 hours' duel with the enemy's batteries and riflemen posted at Sant' Agostino. The Sicilians held the amphitheatre of ancient Capua, a fine defensive position in the plain just outside the town, while 50 Frenchmen, who still named their company after their slain leader, De Flotte, held an isolated farm in front of the amphitheatre with splendid courage all day long. At Garibaldi's order, Tour began thriftily to feed Milbitz with portions of his reserve, which he sent up from Caserta by rail and road. Assanti's regiment was the first to arrive. Some of them deployed in the open to the north of the amphitheatre, while others restored the fight on the railway. Seeing that Santa Maria could hold out for a while, and hearing the noise of battle in the north, the dictator, with Cazio, Missouri, and his staff, mounted into two carriages and drove off towards San Angelo. As the mist rolled away, they saw the road clear before them, and never suspected that the enemy had already crossed it by the sunk lanes and was lying in wait under the Ciccarelli Bridge. At Garibaldi's side sat a young officer of the Piedmontese regular artillery going to serve his guns at San Angelo. He was Emilio Savio, one of the noble pair of brothers who, with their mother, the poetess, were soon to be made famous by Mrs. Browning in every household of Europe and America where English poetry was read. Emilio, as he sat by Garibaldi's side, did not yet know that 3 days before, his brother Alfredo had been shot by the sea in the east, in the trenches beneath Ancona, any more than that he himself was in a few weeks' time beneath the walls of Gaeta, to be shot in the west by the sea. As the carriages drew near the Carcirelli Bridge, the Bourbon infantry in the lane beneath came scrambling up, as if out of the bowels of the earth, and emptied their rifles at the dictator 20 yards away. The horses dashed forward through the midst of them, and as they ran the gauntlet, the coachman and Caricetto of the staff fell mortally wounded. A few yards on the further side of the bridge, one of the horses rolled over, and the carriage was brought to a stand. Garibaldi stepped out into the road and drew his sword. A small group of Medici's infantry from Sant'Angelo, who were fortunately not far off, came running up, and led by the dictator, they charged and repulsed the enemy. After this incident, which had so nearly secured the restoration of the Bourbon dynasty to Naples, Garibaldi made his way on foot to Sant'Angelo, and spent the whole of the morning and the early part of the afternoon in heading charge after charge on the slopes of Monte Tifata and in the streets of the village. The enemy, in greatly superior force, had stormed the advanced battery on the road to Capua, where Dunne fell wounded at the head of his Sicilians, and had poured into the lower part of Sant'Angelo. At the top of the village, Garibaldi's cannon were planted on the terrace in front of the church, and here the struggle raged hottest. other Bourbon troops crossed from the north bank of the Volturno by the ferries and began to ascend Monte Tifata through the forest of San Vito. Garibaldi was here, there, and everywhere, now on horseback, now on foot, now at the church, now on the summit of Monte Tifata, whither he led the Genoese carabineers of the thousand. His criticism of the Bourbon method of attack was that though they advanced bravely, they advanced firing instead of charging with the cold steel. The chief feature of his own method of defense was a series of bayonet charges, each of which drove back the royalists and relieved the pressure for a while. Wherever one of these rushes was being made in defense of Medici's position, whether on the rocky mountainside or on the plain below, there was Garibaldi organizing and leading the charge. His presence put courage into the most faint-hearted of Medici's 4,000 men and made heroes of the bravest. Soon after noonday he began to cry victory wherever he went, and to send off messages to all parts of the field reporting victory all along the line. The phrase kept up the spirits of his outnumbered force, though the veterans muttered under their breath, "Victory! What victory?" In the attack on Sant'Angelo, the Bourbon general, Afan de Rivera, who was in command, incurred censure for not appearing near the front. But in the attack on Santa Maria, General Tabacci did his duty, and the commander-in-chief, Ritucci, exposed himself all day in a manner more suitable to the part of a divisional commander. The knowledge that King Francis was in the field with his brothers, the Counts Trani and Caserta, and his uncle of Trapani, greatly encouraged the assailants. Both sides, an observer noted, fought in silence with the intensity of an Italian vendetta. The Bourbon cavalry made several charges on the plain to the north of the amphitheater, and the infantry penetrated as far as San Prisco. Their guard regiments alone lost 400 killed and wounded, but the grenadiers of the guard sulked and refused to advance a second time against Santa Maria at a moment regarded by Ritucci as the crisis of the battle. The attack directed from Capua on Santa Maria and Sant'Angelo was not the only part of the Bourbon operations on October 1st. It has already been explained how von Mitchell, with 8,000 men acting from the base of Amorosi, had orders to capture Maddaloni and thence advance on Caserta, where it was hoped that they would in the afternoon join hands with the victors of Santa Maria coming from the opposite direction. This wide division of royalist forces was a mistaken strategy, dictated to Ritucci by the council at Gaeta. Von Mitchell now proceeded to make his own account a further mistake of the same character in the manipulation of his 8,000 men. Instead of attacking Bixio's position before Maddaloni with his whole force, he led only 3,000 German-speaking troops down the valley road from Ducenta and detached the 5,000 native troops under Ruiz to make a long circle through the mountains by Limatola, Castle Moroni, and Old Caserta. Von Mitchell declares that he intended Ruiz and his 5,000 to come over the top of Monte Carlo and fall from above onto the left flank of Bixio's position near the Villa Gualtieri at the moment when his own frontal attack was engaging the full attention of the Garibaldini at the arches of the valley. But it was an error to employ 5,000 men for a flank attack, which required speed and mobility rather than numbers, and to keep only 3,000 for the main operation. Perhaps his Swiss pride inspired him to send away all the Neapolitans and to fight a pan-German battle in the valley. Whether from pride or sheer stupidity, he pushed on his own attack with such haste that Ruiz would barely have had time to make his way round over the rocky and trackless mountains, even if he had met with no resistance from the bands of Garibaldini at Castle Moroni or elsewhere. But von Mitchell's worst mistake was that he never gave Ruiz clear orders to cross Monte Carlo and appear on the scene of conflict. He merely instructed him to occupy Old Caserta and there to await developments. "You must keep up communications," so von Mitchell wrote, "between the column attacking Sant'Angelo and my column attacking the arches of the valley." This cannot be read as constituting an order to assist in the Battle of the Arches of the Valley, and yet Von Mitchell conducted his whole operation there on October 1st on the assumption that Ruiz would hasten to his assistance, and after the event blamed him for adhering too literally to his instructions, instead of marching to the sounds of the guns. It may be pleaded in favor of Ruiz that he heard guns firing on both sides of him, at St. Angelo and at the Arches of the Valley, and that the instructions given him by Von Mitchell were to keep up communications between these two battles 8 miles apart. No doubt a Clive or a Blücher would have marched off to decide one or another of the two battles, or else would have seized the opportunity to attack the enemy's headquarters at New Caserta. But Ruiz was an ordinary Neapolitan officer, and was content to carry out his actual instructions a few hours behind time. Von Mitchell, therefore, at 6 in the morning of October 1st, with only 3,000 infantry and 6 mountain guns, attempted to dislodge Bixio from a strong position, which he held with an equal number of guns and 5,600 volunteers. This was the only part of the Battle of the Volturno in which the Royalists were inferior, not in quality but in numbers. The first of Von Mitchell's 3 battalions of foreign troops was composed of Austrians and Bavarians, brave but ill-disciplined, and inclined to be mutinous on questions of food and forced marches. The 2nd battalion consisted chiefly, and the 3rd entirely, of Swiss, many of whom who had been in the Bourbon service for years in the old privileged Swiss regiments disbanded in 1859. They had been accustomed, when in garrison at Maddaloni, to field days in these mountains, and knew every yard of the ground near the aqueduct. Better troops could not have been found in all Europe for the purpose Von Mitchell had in hand. Bixio had chosen to defend Maddaloni at the point where the valley connecting it with Ducenta narrows to a gorge, spanned by the Arches of the Valley, Van Vitelli's colossal aqueduct that carries the water to Caserta Palace. Along the top of the water pipe runs a narrow viaduct, some 200 feet above the valley bottom, and by this aerial footpath Bixio was able to establish rapid communication between his left wing on the slopes of Monte Caro and his right wing on the slopes of Monte Logano. His reserve was behind the left wing, on Monte San Michele and Villa Gualtieri. The Swiss veterans of the 3rd Battalion, dragging up with them a mountain battery, ascended the wooded slopes of Monte Logano and stormed the mills at the eastern end of the aqueduct, driving in flight Bixio's right wing, the Brigade Eberhardt. Von Mitchell's son was killed at the head of the mountaineers of Uri and Unterwald. The attack at the bottom of the valley, directed against the base of the Great Arches, was successful in consequence of the victory on the hillside above. Several Garibaldian officers at the aqueduct, apparently of Eberhardt's Genoese Brigade, led the fight to Maddaloni. A few days later, at Bixio's request, they were degraded in sight of the whole army, at a review held in front of Caserta Palace, with the advice from Garibaldi's own lips to beg for muskets and get themselves killed in the next action. But the left wing under Dezza and Menotti Garibaldi, and the reserves under Fabrizi, behaved so well that even Bixio praised their conduct, especially that of the Sicilians. Bixio, after his right wing had disappeared, still held the western mountain wall of the valley, the lower slopes of the Monte Caro and the pass crowded by the Villa Gualtieri, over which Von Mitchell now attempted to cut his way to Caserta in the plain beyond. The Austrians and Bavarians tried to ascend Monte Caro through the wood from the north, while the victorious Swiss began to climb out of the valley bottom up the precipitous slopes to Villa Gualtieri, and to pour across from Monte Logano along the top of the Arches of the Valley. But the artillery got encumbered in endeavoring to cross the narrow viaduct, and as the infantry struggled uphill through the sparse vineyards and the limestone rocks, they were met by vigorous bayonet charges and hurled back again into the valley bottom. Now was the time that Ruiz should have appeared over the top of Monte Caro, but he was not in sight, and the messengers sent to find him had failed in their mission. At midday, therefore, after 6 hours of fighting, Von Mitchell gave orders to retreat to Ducenta. He acknowledged a loss of 90 men and one gun captured, and over 100 men killed and wounded. Bixio lost no prisoners, but acknowledged a loss of over 200 killed and wounded. Meanwhile, Ruiz and his 5,000 were wandering about useless between the two battles, either of which could have been decided by their presence. Their only orders were to occupy Old Caserta. Arriving at Limatola at dawn, they drove out a few hundred Garibaldian irregulars and followed the road southwards through the hills onto the cultivated tufa plain that lies in the lap of this group of mountains. On the plain stand half a dozen villages round the foot of a conical mountain crowned by the feudal ruin of Castle Marone. In the castle were stationed Pallade Bronzetti and 280 men of Cosenz Brigade, and Ruiz turned aside to storm their position. Bronzetti had expected the villages of Sant'Andrea and Le Annunziata in the plain to be defended for a while by the bands who had retired thither from Limatola, and by 150 of Sacchi's men who had come over from San Lucio. But these all decamped without waiting for the enemy, refusing even to retire up the hill so as to join Bronzetti in the defense of the ruined castle. Bronzetti and his 280 men were therefore left alone in Castle Moroni against Ruiz and his 5,000. The attack was delivered first from the north only, and finally from all sides at once. The Bourbon general himself has recorded that this handful of Garibaldini held out for 4 hours of fierce fighting. Castel Moroni was a well-chosen position for a determined body of men to resist more than 10 times their number. The lonely medieval keep, raised high above the modern life of the plain below, has been inhabited for hundreds of years past only by yellow hawks darting in and out of the upper windows, whence the robber Normans once watched the traffic along the banks of the Volturno. The keep itself is surrounded by a ruined parapet a few yards out, which Bronzetti had caused his men to repair. From the foot of this outer wall, the mountain falls away on every side in a smooth glacis for several hundred yards, and on the south side the straight, bare slope continues for half a mile as far as the villages of the plain. Only on the west is there a neighboring hilltop within long rifle range of the castle. Firing from behind the parapet, the Garibaldini again and again repulsed the enemy, advancing up the glacis of the mountainside. At length their ammunition ran out, but they still resisted, using the bayonet and hurling the heavy blocks of limestone which lay everywhere to their hands. When the royalists at length burst over the wall and into the chambers of the castle, they found Pallade Bronzetti sitting wounded on the ground, and stabbed him to death while he was attempting to negotiate the surrender of his men. He left a name as memorable in Garibaldian history as that of his brother, Narciso, who had been killed the year before at the foot of the Alps. His men were all captured, but not before at least a third of them had been killed or wounded. In the latter stages of his 4 hours' siege, Ruiz, with a part of his force, had been skirmishing at Caselli against a few of Sacchi's men, and had then begun to push on towards Old Caserta. After the fall of Castle Moroni, his whole force proceeded southwards, ascended the Lupara range over the western shoulder of Monte Viro, and reached Old Caserta in the middle of the afternoon, 3.5 hours after Von Mitchell had retreated from before Bixio at the arches of the valley. The appearance of Ruiz's bluecoats on the ridge overlooking the great plain and the sight of the Bourbon flag floating from the castle of Old Caserta were greeted with the ringing of joy bells in the reactionary villages of Casola, San Barbara, and Touro at the foot of the mountain, and struck terror into the liberal inhabitants of New Caserta. The headquarters at the palace were now practically destitute of troops, for Tours, though with some misgivings, had obeyed Garibaldi's orders and started for Santa Maria an hour before with the last of the reserves. Ruiz, however, had no orders to proceed farther than Old Caserta, remained on the top of the mountain all the rest of the day, looking down on the unprotected heart of the enemy's position, but never striking the blow that might so well have proved fatal, if delivered in time. The 4 hours' delay purchased by the heroism of Bronzetti and his handful of men at Castel Moroni very probably saved Garibaldi from destruction. For if Ruiz had arrived at Old Caserta before noon, he would either have been in time to help von Mitchell to a victory over Bixio, or else he would, by threatening New Caserta in the plain, have prevented the departure thence of Tours' reserves for Santa Maria. In the latter case, Santa Maria and Sant'Angelo would have been taken before nightfall. At 3 p.m, the last reserves from Caserta, the Hungarians, Rusto's Milanese, and Eber's North Italians, all picked troops, were brought up by Tour himself to Santa Maria. Almost at the same hour, Garibaldi returned thither from Sant'Angelo. He had been forced to ride round by long and dangerous circuit through Casapola, for the whole plain, as far as San Prisco, was occupied by regiments of royalist foot and horse. He found Santa Maria still holding out, but more like a besieged town than a point in the line of battle. The Frenchmen still held their farmhouse, the Sicilians the amphitheatre, and men and guns were still lodged on part of the railway embankment. But everyone else in that part of the field was packed into the streets of Santa Maria, which presented for hours together a scene of confused resistance and continual slaughter. All through the day fresh men were found ready to die beside the two cannon under the old Roman archway. The town band of Santa Maria, whose 20,000 inhabitants were devoted partisans of the new order, stood plain in the middle of the crowded street to hearten their defenders. Arrived in the middle of this welter, which would have confused a less able soldier, Garibaldi took in the situation on the whole battlefield, and saw that the opportunity of the day had come. He at once determined to lead out northwards the last reserves whom Tour had just brought into the town. In this way alone could he relieve pressure on Santa Maria, and at the same time clear the enemy off the line of communications with Sant'Angelo. While he was giving his last orders in the streets before riding out to try the final issue of his own and country's fortune, his old friend Jessie White, Mario's English wife, came up to him with a glass of water and some figs. He had tasted nothing all day, and he gladly took food and drink from her hands. As he did so, he observed that she was being followed about by a group of British sailors on the spree, with no officer among them, on leave from HMS Hannibal. Being unskilled in Italian, they had fastened on their countrywoman and were employing her to have them supplied with muskets. "What, Jesse, you are helping these sailors to desert their queen?" said Garibaldi good-naturedly, as he sat on his horse eating the figs she had brought him. "They have only come to amuse themselves," she said. They were not supplied with arms, but stood by ready to bear hand in some way more befitting to their country's attitude of benevolent neutrality. The decisive movement now began. Garibaldi, followed by the Hungarians, by Eber's men, and by the Milanese, issued from Santa Maria along the northern road and cleared the enemy off the communications with Sant'Angelo. Eber, continuing up the road towards Ciccarelli Lane and Bridge, where Garibaldi had fallen into the ambush in the morning, relieved the pressure on Medici. But the dictator himself, followed by the Hungarians and Milanese, wheeled to the left, not far outside Santa Maria, and swept the field in the direction of Capua. The onslaught with fixed bayonets of fresh and vigorous troops under such a leader could not be resisted by the masses of the enemy, who had been firing for hours past without making further headway. The 200 Hungarian cavaliers, Garibaldi's only mounted force, were at length let loose. They went right over the batteries and on through regiment after regiment. Too few to rout the whole army, they were too brave and too skilled with horse and sword to be stopped anywhere on this side of the walls of Capua. Singly and in small groups, as evening fell, the survivors rode back, well satisfied that they had honored the Magyar name before the eyes of Europe. Behind the 200 horsemen followed the ranks of levelled bayonets with Garibaldi in the midst of them. 200 Hungarian infantry and 600 Milanese, deploying to north and south of Parisi farmhouse, with their faces towards Capua station, drove the enemy's tired regiments before them. The royalists, as they were retreated, turned round to fire, and still, here and there, rallied for a stand under a covering charge of cavalry. But Garibaldi still came on, and in the rear and on the left of the men whom he was leading came the defenders pouring out from Santa Maria, men of Sicily, of Calabria, of Tuscany, and of all the other provinces of United Italy. Sant'Agostino had been deserted by the enemy, and now the cemetery and the Cappuccini convent were stormed, and D'Angelo's farm to the north of the road, Medici too, relieved by Eber's advance, sallied out from Sant'Angelo and recaptured the battery where Dunne had been wounded in the morning. All the advanced positions which had been lost at dawn when the Bourbon army came out of Capua in the fog were reoccupied before sunset. The masses of beaten royalists, converging from north and south upon the parade ground before Capua, retreated sullenly through the gate whence they had issued with such high hopes 12 hours before. While Garibaldi rode back to Sant'Angelo through the dusk, his men lay down exhausted and hungry on the ground, each man where he stood, knowing that they had saved Italy. An epilogue to the decisive battle of the 1st of October took place the following day. Ruiz and his 5,000 on the hilltop of Old Caserta had spent the afternoon and night in complete ignorance of the result of the fighting before Capua or at the arches of the valley. Early on the morning of October 2nd, news reached them of the double defeat of Ritucci and of von Mitchell. Ruiz thereupon held a council of war, at which he decided to retreat at once to the north bank of the Volturno, while the way was still open. Nearly 3,000 of his men obeyed the order to retreat and escape through the Limatola, but more than 2,000, seized by a sudden impulse for battle and plunder, refused to obey their general, and descended off the mountain, officers and men together, to attack Caserta in the plain below. Part of them advanced through the park and by way of the cascade, driving a company of Sacchi's men before them down the wooded hillside. Others made straight into Caserta town through Casola and Altifreda. A panic seized the few troops defending Caserta, and the royalists entered in triumph and commenced sacking the houses. But all this while Garibaldi was throwing his net around them with equal energy and skill. He had already caused his orders to be conveyed to Bixio, bidding him come over Monteviro and cut them off from the northeast. He himself, with such troops from Sant'Angelo as were not completely prostrated by their efforts of the day before, crossed the tracks over Monte Tifata and arrived at San Lucio a little after 9 in the morning. Here he effected a junction with Sacchi and with some troops just arrived by train from Naples, who had taken no part in the battle of October 1st, namely Stoccos, Calabrians, and a few companies of Piedmontese, Bersaglieri, and other regulars. Led on by Garibaldi himself, the picked troops of Victor Emmanuel's army, in their round hats with cock's feathers, climbed through the steep park in the direction of Old Caserta, side by side with the red shirts and the gaitered Calabrians in their brigand costume. Before he himself began to mount the hill from San Lucio, the dictator had detached thence a few score of Genoese carabineers of the 1,000 by the lower road to save the palace and to clear the enemy out of Caserta in the plain. The Genoese charged into the main street of Caserta, singing Mameli's hymn of 48, and after a sharp struggle in which a dozen fell on each side, drove the horde of plunderers back out of the town and up the hills towards Old Caserta. Meanwhile, the larger force under the dictator was shepherding the other flocks of Bourbon infantry out of the park and up towards the same point on the hills above. Before long, the whole 2,000, emerging from brushwood and the olive groves below, were to be seen flying for their lives along the stony flanks of the mountain towards Old Caserta. At this moment Bixio's force appeared over the top of Montevero, barring their flight northwards. The net closed in upon them, and after another hour spent in hunting detachments of various sizes over the Great Bear Plateau, 2,012 men and 77 officers were secured as prisoners of war. Taking all parts of the Battle of the Volturno together, the Garibaldini officially acknowledged a loss on the 2 days of 306 killed, 1,328 wounded, and 389 missing. Of these losses, scarcely 50 can be attributed to the fighting on the second day. At Castle Moroni there were under 300 lost, most of them prisoners, and at the Arches of the Valley rather more than 200 killed and wounded. It follows that some 1,400 must have been killed or wounded in the main battle of October 1st, in defense of the line of Santa Maria and Sant'Angelo over against Capua. The Bourbon generals officially acknowledged a loss in that part of the field of 1,065 men, 260 killed, 731 wounded, and 74 prisoners. Besides 200 more lost at the Arches of the Valley on October the 1st, and 2,089 prisoners taken near Old Caserta on October the 2nd. Garibaldi had now nearly 1,500 wounded on his hands, besides large numbers of sick disabled by constant exposure and underfeeding at the outposts. As the autumn drew on, long gray overcoats were served out, which gave the army a more uniform appearance, besides some chance of warmth at night. But the conditions of service before Capua continued to be very severe. The Neapolitans did little or nothing to make life more comfortable for their deliverers. Those of the wounded who were sent back to the capital fared far worse than those left at the front, for the usual peculation and carelessness of the hospital officials, and the consequent dirt and absence of necessaries, were not remedied on behalf of the Garibaldini, except to some degree by British help in the form of materials and money from England, and personal service by some of our country women in Naples. The field hospitals at Caserta and Santa Maria, though far from perfect, were better, being under the control of the medical staff of Tours division, and under the eye of Jessie White Mario herself. The English women in the hospital of Naples were deeply affected by the patience and gentleness of the North Italian wounded, and by their complete unselfishness. Indeed, their only anxiety seemed to be not to give trouble, by any complaints, however reasonable, to Garibaldi or to those who had volunteered to nurse them. In spite of the pain and squalor of their lot, the wounded were not unhappy, for there were days in October on which Garibaldi was in the capital, when he never failed to visit them, stopping to speak with each one and to make the dying envied by some special mark of his gratitude and love. "All the men," writes an English lady, "when they heard him coming, began to sit up in their beds and clap their hands and shout, 'Papa Nostro, Papa Nostro!' They longed to be allowed coffee in the morning instead of grease and water, so my sister said to one of them, 'Now ask the general to order that you have coffee.' The young man answered, 'O lady, how could I trouble him with that, when he has so much to see to, and when his very presence gives us new life?'" The Battle of the Volturno, the last of Garibaldi's great fears of war, differs from Como, Calatafimi, Palermo, Milazzo, the crossing of the Straits. Firstly, because it shows him acting on the defensive, and secondly, because it shows him handling some 20,000 men, a larger number than the handful of guerrillas, which, according to his critics, was all he could command with success. His defensive strategy on this occasion is excellent, and proves that he had learnt much about the conditions of European warfare since his defense of Rome in 1849, on his return from the South American pampas. While the Bourbon generals on October 1st went out of their way to divide their army and attack him from the east, north, and west at once, Garibaldi made full use of the central position in which they thus placed him. Communications between the various parts of the assailing force were therefore lost, with the result that Ruiz's division was of no practical use to Ritucci on the great day and was destroyed in detail on October 2nd. Garibaldi, on the other hand, took advantage of his central position and of his short line of communication strung together by the Maladoni-Caserta-Santa Maria railway to keep his reserve under Tor at the central point between the various battlefields until the very last moment. He could thus postpone the vital decision as to whether the reserve should be sent from Caserta to Santa Maria or from Caserta to Maddaloni until events showed where they were most needed. The arrival of this body of fresh troops at Santa Maria, halfway through the afternoon, and the vigorous use which he made of them to attack the enemy's tired regiments, decided the even balance of the day. The success of the national army in holding its own against greatly superior numbers is therefore to be attributed apart from the valor of the volunteers to three qualities shown on this occasion by Garibaldi. The personal inspiration of his presence at so many of the important points, the combined caution and vigor of his offensive-defensive tactics, and last but not least, a sound strategy governing the disposition of his men over the whole region of conflict from the arches of the valley to the gate of Capua. End of chapter 13. Chapter 14 of Garibaldi and the Making of Italy by George Macaulay Trevelyan. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Meeting of Garibaldi and Victor Emmanuel. To watch the new kingdom of Italy rising as it were by magic is a marvelous sight. When time has veiled the events of the period and wiped away all that is perfidious and adventurous, Cavour, Victor Emmanuel, and Garibaldi will stand forth as heroes of this epoch. While I am writing of the struggles and sufferings of Rome in the Middle Ages, the observation of the present, which is realizing the work of which centuries have despaired, is an experience of inestimable value to the historian. Gregorius Diary, Rome, November 1860. The Battle of the Volturno saved Naples from the Bourbons, but it did not deliver Capua to Garibaldi. It redressed the balance of war which had begun to incline against him, but it did not weigh down the scales on his side. A condition of military stalemate continued for more than 3 weeks of October, until Victor Emmanuel's army arrived upon the scene. During this period of waiting, the only military event of interest was the expedition to Isernia. The town, like most others in the Molise and in the neighboring province of Abruzzi, had been seized by the citizens in the name of Garibaldi and Victor Emmanuel. But on the day before the Battle of the Volturno, it was invaded by peasants from the hills, authorized to act for the good cause by their bishop and by the authorities at Gaeta, and led on by royal gendarmes. During the following week, pillage, massacre, torture, and mutilation were the lot of the inhabitants of Isernia and of other centers of nationalism in the neighborhood. This system of reaction or brigandage, accompanied by all the bestial cruelty of which the half-savage peasants of the South were still capable, afforded a last weapon for the expiring system of church and state. Francis II, when finally driven from Gaeta by Victor Emmanuel's army, took refuge in Rome in 1861, and thence, under the protection of the Pope, continued to foster this kind of brigandage in his lost dominions in the Abruzzi for nearly 7 years to come. No such horrors were committed on the other side by the Garibaldian peasantry of Calabria, Basilicata, Abruzzi, or any other province of the mainland, and the difference may fairly be attributed to the higher ethical standard of the local nationalist leaders, men like Stocco and Pace, touched by the idealism of the Risorgimento movement, as compared with the reactionary clergy and the Bourbon officials, who had been brought up in an evil school on frankly medieval ideas of religion and government. Early in October, nationalist refugees from the neighborhood of Acerna arrived at Caserta, told the tale of horror to Garibaldi, and assured him that if he would send some of his officers into the Molise, they would there find 3,000 peasants ready to place themselves under their orders and suppress the reaction. The dictator accordingly sent Nulo, Mario, and Sazio in command of a few hundred Sicilians and irregulars from the Alife district and a few dozen North Italians. When they arrived in the Molise, there was no sign of the 3,000 friendly natives who were to have joined them. The reactionary peasants, backed by several battalions of Bourbon regulars, fell upon them near Isernia on October 17th and drove them out of the Molise with heavy loss. In the Abruzzi, the liberals held their own, but eagerly awaited the crossing of the Taranto by Victor Emmanuel. On October 15th, the British Legion, otherwise called the Garibaldi Excursionists, landed in Naples, over 600 strong. They looked a fine body of men as they marched up the Toledo in their red tunics with green facings, the muzzles of their Enfield rifles stuffed with flowers by the admiring populace. 4 days later, they gave a good account of themselves in a skirmish in front of Sant'Angelo, conducted up to the walls of Capua, where they lost 2 killed and 8 wounded. But the warning that Dunne had uttered when Garibaldi consulted him at Milazzo as to the advisability of allowing such a region to be recruited was unfortunately borne out by events. One part of the excursionists consisted of roughs, principally from Glasgow and London, who considered that they were out for a holiday at other people's expense, and though they did not object to the fighting, expected a maximum of food and good quarters and a minimum of discipline. The other half, old soldiers, volunteers, and generous enthusiasts of all classes from a duke's son downwards, could not, by their own better conduct, save the legion from acquiring a name for disorder similar to that which the Pope's Irish had acquired in Rome. "You see," said the Italians indulgently, "these men are not accustomed to a country where wine is cheap." Paird, whom the dictator set over them as colonel, was not so well qualified for this difficult command as for the individual knight-errantry which had made him a well-beloved figure in the Garibaldian field armies for 18 months past. If the campaign had been prolonged and carried to the walls of Rome, as the committee in London had expected when it raised the legionnaires, there is little doubt they would have done us credit. As things were, although the legion came too late, the fame of our country had been upheld throughout the campaign, and yeoman service rendered to the Italian cause by the English free lances, by Dunne and Wyndham, by Paird and Dowling, and by others who have survived them. Garibaldi estimated accurately the limits of the degree to which he had improved his position by the recent victory on the Volturno. One day, soon after the battle, he came to Mario with a letter from Mazzini in his hand. "Read this," he said. "Mazzini urges me on to attack Rome. You know that I have long been thinking of it. On the 1st of October we defeated the enemy so that they cannot meet us again in the open field. But I cannot advance on Rome, leaving behind me 60,000 men entrenched in Capua and Gaeta, who can march into Naples the moment my back is turned." He fully accepted the political consequences of the military situation. He abandoned all idea of advancing on Rome and prepared to welcome the immediate advent of Victor Emmanuel. Cavour, gravely anxious that Italy should present a united front to the monarchs of Austria, Prussia, and Russia, who were about to hold an ominous conference at Warsaw, desired above all else that the dictator should go out to welcome the king in the face of Italy and Europe, and was much concerned lest he should sail home to Caprera in dudgeon before Victor Emmanuel's arrival. This, rather than any fears of actual civil war, appears to have been the limit of Cavour's anxiety with regard to Garibaldi from the first days of October onwards. The minister wisely sought counsel with Garibaldi's oldest and best friend, Augusto Vecchi, who had worn the red shirt beside his chief in South America, who had fought shoulder to shoulder with him in the midnight melee when the French troops burst through the defences of the Janiculum, and from whose house at Quarto Garibaldi had sailed with the thousand for Sicily. On October 1st, Vecchi wrote to Garibaldi to implore him to hasten the plebiscite for the annexation of Naples and to send a message inviting Victor Emmanuel to march without delay into his new dominions. 3 days later, Vecchi wrote again, "Invite the king personally by a telegram to come quickly to Naples and to go meet him. I ask this of you in the name of Italy, our mother, for whose greatness we too swore many years ago to make every kind of sacrifice." On the very day when Vecchi was writing in this strain, Garibaldi had already yielded the point and was inditing his famous letter to Victor Emmanuel, which, besides many expressions of goodwill and desire for unity, contained the following words, "Sire, I congratulate Your Majesty on the brilliant victories won by your brave General Cialdini and on their happy results. Since Your Majesty is at Ancona, you must make a journey to Naples by land or by sea. If by land, as would be best, Your Majesty ought to march with at least one division. If I were informed in time, I would move forward my right wing to meet you, and would come in person to present my homage, and to receive your orders as to the final operations." Cavour, therefore, as early as October 4th, had gained his point that Garibaldi should invite the king and go out to meet him. But for another 10 days there was trouble on the further question of the plebiscite, a controversy which became the storm centre of the last political crisis of the dictatorship. The question at issue was the proper method of obtaining the consent of the inhabitants of the Neapolitan kingdom to their absorption of the monarchy of Victor Emmanuel. Should they be consulted directly by plebiscite, by a simple referendum on the question of annexation, to which each elector would answer by his vote, yes or no? Or should they place their fate in the hands of an assembly of elected representatives, who might then propose conditions on which the South would come into the National Union? Such were the two alternatives, and the choice between them was a question of more than mere form. If Italy had no armed enemies to fear, either within or without the barrier of her guardian Alps, if she had been in safe possession of her own house, then indeed she ought to have gone about the difficult business of setting it in order with long and careful deliberation. If the union of the North and South Italy, like the union of North and South Britain in 1707, had been proposed in a year when the two kingdoms were immune from invasion and revolution, then indeed a parliament at Naples and a parliament at Palermo might reasonably have sat for many months bargaining with the Parliament at Turin. In such a case, some of the evils that have actually resulted from a too close union might possibly have been avoided. Those who know South Italy of today deplore the rigid and mechanical application of the Piedmontese laws and administrative system to a state of society very different from that of the subalpine populations, and they deplore no less than the immense powers of self-government under which the Constitution of 1860 have been committed to the backward communes of the South. But this was the necessary price that Italy paid for her existence. In the crisis of that autumn, with war and revolution still in the bowels of the land, with an Austrian army eagerly awaiting the word to cross the Mincio and rush on Milan, with the French minister already withdrawn from Turin, and every great European power except England hostile to the unification of Italy, it would have been the height of unwisdom to waste 2 months in electing and calling together Neapolitan and Sicilian assemblies, and a half a year more in bargainings and intrigues of every kind, public and personal, into which Southern parliamentarians would instinctively plunge and revel, if they found that they had their country in their gift, and Cavour on his knees to them to hand it over. If Italian unity were to be accomplished at all, and all were agreed that there was no other port of safety in sight, then it must be done at once by direct acceptance of Piedmontese laws and custom for the whole peninsula, not because that was best for all, but because that alone could be established everywhere without delay. A plebiscite for unconditional annexation could be held in a fortnight, but an assembly might sit until it was dispersed by Austrian bayonets. The men who in the second week of October besieged Garibaldi with petitions for an assembly instead of the plebiscite were not, with the exception of the Federalist Cantenio, primarily interested in obtaining a separate system of administration for the South. Their opposition to the plebiscite was essentially factious. Crispi and his friends desired an assembly where they might hope to dominate, and they objected to a plebiscite because it would, in a fortnight's time, bring an end to the Garibaldian dictatorship, which, so long as it lasted, left the executive power in their hands and kept out the hated Cavour. They played on the dictator's distrust of the minister. They cunningly reminded him that the plebiscite had been the device by which Napoleon III had filched Nice and Savoy. There had arisen one of those complicated situations through which Garibaldi was least able to see his way in the light of the new simple rules by which he guided his conduct. His mind was darkened, and he sat stupefied at the head of the council board while the rival parties of plebiscite and assembly defied each other shrilly across the room. Between October 11th and 13th, a series of such councils were held at Caserta and in Naples. Old Giorgio Pallavicino, the martyr of the Spielberg, the Austrian dungeon where he had sat for 14 years in the early days of the Risorgimento movement, was now Garibaldi's pro-dictator of the Neapolitan mainland. He it was who stood in the breach against Crispi and Cattaneo on behalf of the immediate Italian unity. On October 11th at Caserta, Garibaldi decided for Crispi and an assembly. Pallavicino at once gave his resignation, and the city of Naples rose in a great demonstration of protest in his favor. On all doors, windows, carriages, coats and hats appeared cards inscribed C, or yes, the vote that all desired to be allowed to give in plebiscite. Garibaldi returned to the capital to find the streets in an uproar. He heard Pallavicino's name coupled with his own for vivas, and while Morte was cried out against Mazzini, Crispi, and the others who had persuaded him to summon an assembly. All along the Toledo it snowed seas into the carriage. Garibaldi was much perturbed by this clear manifestation of the popular will, for obedience to the people was one of the formulae of his creed, in accordance with which he had long ago abandoned his republicanism in order to be in touch with his fellow citizens. On the 13th, another council was held in his rooms at the Palazzo d'Angri. Pallavicino refused to take back his resignation unless the plan for an assembly were cancelled. In the middle of an angry dispute between the pro-dictator and Crispi, Tour produced a petition signed by thousands of hands in favor of the plebiscite. Garibaldi bowed his head over it in melancholy silence, and for some minutes his face was hidden. When he looked up, the clouds had cleared away, and he wore the serene gaiety of his happiest and gentlest mood. "If this is the desire of the Neapolitan people," he said, "it must be satisfied." "Caro Giorgio," he said to Pallavicino, "we need you here still." The same evening Crispi resigned the secretariat, and his part in the history of Italy came to an end for that year. The plebiscite was held on October 21st. The electorate had no choice but to vote yes or no to the following proposition: "The people wishes for Italy one and indivisible, with Victor Emmanuel as constitutional king and his legitimate descendants after him." The result was shortly afterwards declared as follows: Neapolitan mainland, 1,302,064 yes, 10,312, no. Sicily, 432,053, yes. 667, no. The voting was open, and everyone who voted no did so in the face of a disapproving world. No doubt, therefore, the real minority was a very much larger proportion of the citizens. But if the plebiscite exaggerated, it did not belie the opinion of the people. Whether the majority of the inhabitants of South Italy wished for Italian unity on its own merits, it's fairly open to question, but they had shown in more ways than one their earnest desire for immediate and unconditional annexation as the only security against the return of the House of Bourbon and the dreadful past from which Garibaldi had delivered them. Meanwhile, Victor Emmanuel was coming to take possession of his new dominions. On the afternoon of September 29th, he left Turin on his triumphal progress that was yet a most perilous adventure, hoping that when he wanted to return, he would not find his northern capital occupied by Austrians or by French. Passing through Bologna to the Ravennese coast, he embarked on October 3rd for Ancona. A storm arose, the frigate was in great danger, and the seamen declared that the safest course was to run across the Adriatic towards Pola in Austrian territory. But Victor Emmanuel, refusing to be put into the hands of his enemies at such a crisis of Italian affairs, came on deck to encourage the sailors and remained there throughout the storm, while his staff officers were prostrated below. Towards evening the sea went down, and before midnight they entered the harbour of Ancona, where the king was welcomed ashore by Fanti, Cialdini, Della Rocca, and their victorious troops. Some delay occurred in starting from Ancona, but on October 9th the great march began, the whole army moving, with the king in the midst, along the road to Naples. He passed near the battlefield of Castelfidardo, through Macerata and Loreto, and thence along the Adriatic coast. He reached Grotto Mare, the last town in Papal territory, on October 11th, and remained there 4 days inactive, probably from some cautionary reasons of diplomacy or politics. These were the days during which the political crisis on the question of the plebiscite was taking place in Naples. Only on October 15th, after Pallavicino had triumphed over Crispi, did the king cross the Taranto and enter the Neapolitan kingdom. After following the coast road as far as the fortress of Pescara, which had already come into the national cause, they turned inland by way of Chieti and Popoli to Sulmona. Thus far, in Papal and Neapolitan territory alike, the enthusiasm of the liberated people for their new king had been abundantly shown. All classes, including very many of the clergy, joined in the demonstrations, and triumphal arches and addresses of welcome impeded the rate of military progress. It was felt that no offense must be given to the king's new subjects, and he showed as much rough graciousness as his impatient nature contained. Other causes of delay were the neglected state of the high road, and the absence of bridges over the innumerable dry torrent beds through which the siege guns and commissariat wagons had to pass. For this was not a Garibaldian army. It moved slowly, but it was bringing with it the means to take Capua and Gaeta. After they had passed Sulmona, the political sympathies of the inhabitants were less unanimous. There was still an enthusiastic Italian party to welcome them, but at every turn of the road they saw fresh evidence of civil war and massacre. The good Italians came in with stories, usually only too true, of massacre and mutilation which their relations and friends had suffered. Rough justice was administered on the roadside by Piedmontese court-martials assisted by firing parties, and a proclamation was issued that all peasants found with arms in their hands would be shot. Even in this district, some of the parish priests showed themselves on the national side. Cialdini, with the vanguard, was now 2 days' march in front of the king. On October 20th, near Isernia, where a handful of Garibaldini had been repulsed only 3 days before, he fell in with 5,000 Bourbon troops under General Scotti. Scotti neglected to send out scouts or advanced guard, and marched his men in a column right up to Cialdini's hidden batteries. The Bersaglieri and line regiments were let loose upon the enemy's surprised and disordered mass, and the Lancers of Novara charged through the whole length of their column. In a few minutes, Scotti, with nearly 1,000 of his men, had been captured, and the rest dispersed over the countryside in hopeless disbandment. On October 25th, Garibaldi crossed the Volturno by a crazy bridge of planks a yard wide, supported on boats, which had been flung across at the ferry of Formicola. The Italians had failed to make any bridge at all, with the scant materials to hand, but the task had been accomplished by the British Legion, with the expert assistance of some handymen who appeared to be their fellow countrymen, and showed a suspicious readiness for any service connected with ropes and water. The making of the bridge had been conducted under fire, but the Bourbon troops, who had already abandoned Cajazzo, withdrew towards Capua, and did not attempt to dispute the passage of the river after the bridge had been completed. Leaving Medici to protect the lines at Sant'Angelo, Garibaldi with a few regiments of Italians and the British Legion advanced northwards through Bologna and Calvi to meet Victor Manuel. They bivouacked on the night of October 25th to the 26th in the broad valley between the hills of Caginello and Vigirano, where the high road then, as the railway now, debouches from the gates of the wooded mountains into flatter country that soon broadens out into the great plains of Capua. Most of the troops slept by the roadside below, but some were stationed on the heights of Vigirano, whence their watchfires could be seen afar by three armies. For below them lay the camp of their fellow Garibaldini, close at hand to the south were the Bourbon regiments, and a few miles to the north lay Victor Emmanuel's army, the corps of Della Rocca and of Cialdini, side by side on two converging roads, with the king's quarters between them. On the morning of October 26th, an Englishman among the Garibaldian outposts, who was sleeping in a dry ditch, was awakened by shouts of "Vive il Re!" Accustomed to hear "Long live the King" as the Bourbon war cry, he sprang up half awake, thinking the enemy were upon them. Next moment he saw his mistake. Victor Emmanuel, King of Italy, was riding by. About the same hour, the Garibaldini on the hills of Vigirano awoke to see the whole Italian army, in all the panoply of war, move swiftly along the valley below towards the camp of the Redshirts on the edge of the great plain. Garibaldi had overnight sent on Missouri and Zazio to the royal camp to announce his presence and offer his homage. At dawn, he himself rode out with his staff to find the king, and stationed himself in front of the Tolbar Tavern, a rustic cottage with a few poplars near it, at the point of junction of the two roads along which the royal army was coming. The dictator and his staff, including Canzio, and Mario with Missouri and Zazio, who now rejoined them, dismounted in front of the tavern and took their stand a little off the road along which the northern regiments filed past. Battalion after battalion went by, gazing on Garibaldi, some with unmingled enthusiasm, gratitude, and love, others with a greater or less mixture of professional jealousy and political distrust. Generals Della Rocca and Cialdini both greeted him warmly that morning, and were warmly welcomed in return, for neither of them was touched with that jealousy of the volunteers, which embittered Fanti and many others among the regular officers. The victor of Castelfiardo and the liberator of Sicily and Naples were divided by no cloud of petty rivalry, and if Cialdini instead of Fanti had been commander-in-chief of the Italian army, Cavour's instructions to show gratitude to the Garibaldini would have been heartily obeyed. Much might have been forgotten and forgiven on both sides in the enthusiasm of the meeting, and the Serbonian bog of mutual reprisals and recrimination might have been shunned. So the early morning wore on, while regiment after regiment of the Royal Army marched past the Liberator. It was a damp autumn air, and Garibaldi was not only wearing his poncho, but had, in homely fashion, bound a colored handkerchief over his head. His staff, in their war-stained red shirts, presented a curious contrast to the brilliant uniforms that were filing by them hour by hour. Suddenly the strains of the royal march were heard, and the cry arose, "The king! The king is coming!" Garibaldi and his staff mounted their horses and rode forward to the edge of the road. Victor Emmanuel, on a prancing Arab, dashed up to meet them. The dictator, sweeping his hat off his kerchiefed head, cried aloud, "Saluto il primo re d'Italia! I hail the first king of Italy!" The king stretched out his hand, and the two men clasped their held hands for more than a minute. "Come state, caro Garibaldi?"
"Bene, maestro. E lei?"
"Benone." Then they rode on together, and the two staffs behind them, red shirts side by side with resplendent uniforms, crosses, and cordons of honor. It was an epitome of the union of conservative and revolutionary forces that had crushed the obscurantists and expelled the foreigners. The constrained conversation between the two groups betrayed the heart-burnings on either side and the grudging sacrifices that each was making to the other. But although there was a cold politeness where there should have been enthusiasm, nonetheless that ride together was the making of Italy, and seen down history's lengthening vista, remains evermore a goodly sight. After a while, Garibaldi and his men turned off the road to the left and made their way back by country lanes to Calvi, while the king held on to Teano. Garibaldi's countenance, writes Mario, was full of melancholy sweetness. Never did I feel drawn to him with such tenderness. He said little that evening to his friends. Next morning they met Jesse Mario, who had crossed the Volturno to provide hospital arrangements north of the river.
"My wounded," said Garibaldi to her somewhat sternly, "are all on the south of the Volturno."
And then, relapsing into his gentlest mood, he added, "Jesse, they have sent us to the rear." During their ride together, Victor Emmanuel had told him in soft words the hard decree that the Royal Army would take over all the operations of war and that the Garibaldini were no longer required. End of chapter 14. Chapter 15 of Garibaldi and the Making of Italy by George Macaulay Trevelyan. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Return to Caprera. Semplici in anti e simpli in parole, ci della patria cavalier si sense, donna tutta alla patria e nulla vole. Marradi. Rhapsody Garibaldina. Simply in act and word, his country's knight, he gives his country all and nothing takes. That part of the enemy's force which had been in the neighborhood of the two national armies at the moment of their junction on October 26th retired in the afternoon towards Gaeta and effaced themselves behind the line of Garigiano. On the morning of the 27th, Victor Manuel rode from Teano to Calvi in search of Garibaldi. Finding that he had returned to the south bank of the Volturno, the king pushed on alone with his staff in the same direction, crossed the rickety little bridge, and entered the Garibaldian lines at San Angelo. The volunteers came swarming out to welcome the unexpected visitor with cries of devotion and enthusiasm, which showed how far a very little attention from the world would have gone to win the hearts of the main body of Garibaldini. Unfortunately, this surprise visit was the last effort which His Majesty was permitted to make by way of showing personal gratitude to the rank and file of the volunteers. Since Garibaldi was absent, not knowing of the king's visit, Medici did the honors of the occasion, helped by Nino Bixio's lieutenants. Bixio himself was in hospital at Naples.
at the crossing of the Volturno 2 days before, whence he was to have accompanied the dictator to meet the king. Nino had headed a hue and cry after a priest suspected of acting as a spy, and riding furiously after the man to arrest him, had let his horse slip in a narrow lane and fractured his leg against the wall. He lay, however, quite happy in the hospital at Naples, for his wife came out from Genoa to nurse him, and since the volunteers' part in the fighting was over, he was able to turn his mind to the docile family affections which shared dominion in his heart with the rage for his country's service. Victor Emmanuel, after having fraternized with Medici's men, had ridden close up to the walls of Capua at the greatest risk of being cut off by the enemy's outposts, recrossed the Volturno, and returned to Teano. His army was there divided into two, one part going towards the line of the Garigiano and Gaeta, and the other under General Della Rocca coming south to besiege Capua. Della Rocca had to negotiate a delicate situation with Garibaldi. Although the red shirts were no longer to be allowed to take part in the serious operations of the campaign, yet on October 28th their services were still required for yet a few days longer to help guard the lines for the royal siege batteries. Garibaldi, fearing that his men might be annoyed at receiving orders from Della Rocca if they considered that a slight was being put upon themselves, or their chief not wholly placed in the whole of his army at the absolute disposal of the Piedmontese general, but was at pains to devise a plan whereby Della Rocca's orders were conveyed to the Red Shirts through Sidori, as though they still came from Garibaldi himself. He strictly enjoined his staff to prevent the men from knowing that the orders did not in reality emanate from him. Shaking his supplanter warmly by the hand, he wished him luck and rode off to Caserta. 2 days later, Della Rocca, who had been deeply touched by Garibaldi's generous conduct, hearing that he was ill at Caserta, went there to pay him a visit. He found him in a little room over the guardhouse of the palace, exactly above a large store of gunpowder. "I begged him," writes Della Rocca, "to move immediately, and smiling he promised to do so. Propped up with pillows, he was wrapped in a military cloak, a little cap on his head, and a silk handkerchief knotted around his neck. As I entered, he held out his hand, and seemed quite touched when I told him I had only come to ask how he was. He was still more pleased when I told him how well I got on with his generals Cosenz and Sertori, notable personages and most excellent men, and how I regretted the enforced absence of Bixio. Mine were no idle compliments. I meant what I said, and I saw that Garibaldi was pleased that I appreciated his friends." Meanwhile, Della Rocca's batteries were being scientifically erected by the engineers of the regular army in front of the Garibaldian lines. On November 1st at 4 p.m, all was ready, and a red flag run upon the summit of Monte Tifata gave the signal for the bombardment. The enemy replied, and the duel lasted on through the night. Some of the houses in the town were set on fire, and the Capuans, many of whom secretly hated the falling dynasty, protested to the general of the garrison the necessity for instant surrender. At dawn of November 2nd, the officers of the terrace of Sant'Angelo Church eagerly turned their telescopes towards Capua and saw the white flag hoisted on its walls. The garrison of 10,000 men became prisoners of war, and the fortress that had set a limit to Garibaldi's career at length surrendered to the Italian army. While Della Rocca was taking Capua, Fanti and Cialdini were drawing the net around Gaeta. On October 29th, a reconnaissance against the enemy's strong position on the hills behind the mouth of Garigliano was pushed too far, partly by the carelessness of the generals, partly by the unwillingness of the Bersaglieri to obey the orders to retreat. The action cost the Italian army over 50 men and showed that their opponents could still fight. But a day or two later, when the Italian fleet opened fire on their flank and rear, the Bourbon forces abandoned the position on the Garigiano and fell back towards the great fortress. On November 2nd, the day of the fall of Capua, a successful action at Mola di Gaeta on the coast was placed by the Italian army in a situation to besiege Gaeta in form. During the first 10 days of November, some 17,000 Neapolitan soldiers, closely pursued by Victor Manuel's troops, escaped over the frontier into Papal territory at Terracina, and were disarmed and interned among the Alban Hills by the Papal authorities and the French garrisons of Rome. The remainder of the Bourbon army that had not already disbanded or surrendered was now shut up in the citadel at Messina, in one or two small forts in Sicily and the Abruzzi, or with the ex-king and queen in Gaeta. The siege of Gaeta was protracted all the winter, because Napoleon III kept the French fleet in those waters with orders to prevent the Italian fleet from bombarding the fortress. The siege operations had therefore to be conducted entirely from the land side and were not brought to a successful issue until February 1861. The long siege enabled Maria Sophia, Francis II's young Bavarian queen, to display to Europe from the battlements of the bombarded fortress a heroine's courage which illuminated with sunset glow the last vision of the inglorious dynasty which had known no rays at noontide. Napoleon's action in stopping the war at sea while allowing it to be carried to its conclusion on land had no permanent effect save to irritate Italians and to efface from their minds all claims of gratitude for his recent compliance with regard to Umbria and the Marches. It is difficult, at first sight, to assign a reason for interference at once so feeble and so exasperating. The emperor's biographer, unable as ever to understand his sympathy with Italian freedom, supposes that he wished to clear his personal honor by this tangible protest against Victor Manuel's piratical attack on the Kingdom of Naples. Such may be the feelings of a French clerical in the face of the liberation of Italy, but it is difficult to suppose that they were those of Napoleon III, only 2 months after he had given his consent to Cavour's invasion of the Papal Marches. The secret agreement which he had made at Chambéry was that the North Italian army should invade and traverse the Papal territories so as to arrive at Naples in time to stop Garibaldi and absorb the revolution. In making this arrangement, Napoleon did not imagine that Victor Emmanuel had undertaken to put down Garibaldi merely in order to restore Francis II to the throne. The emperor did not like the annexation of South Italy by Piedmont, but he had agreed to it as the least of many possible evils. Therefore, his motive in sending the French fleet to Gaeta was probably not so much genuine indignation at the conduct of the King of Italy as the perception that he must appear to be angry for the sake of the French clericals, whose loyalty, so essential to his throne, he had strained almost to the breaking point. On the 8th of October, Cavour had written to Farini, the minister in attendance on Victor Emmanuel. "If Garibaldi's army acclaims the king, it must be treated well if we have to contend against the requirements and pedantries of the regular army. Do not give in. Reasons of state of the first importance demand firmness. Woe to us if we show ourselves ungrateful to those who have shed their blood for Italy. Europe would condemn us. In the country, there would be a great reaction in favor of the Garibaldini. I have had a warm argument with Fanti on this point. He spoke of military requirements. I replied that this was not Spain, and that here the army had to obey." It was a great misfortune that Cavour was unable to secure the fulfillment, in spirit as well as in letter, of his wise and benevolent intentions. Victor Emmanuel, who had hitherto been more enthusiastic for Garibaldi than Cavour himself, fell at this critical moment under the influence of Fanti and the military pendants. Garibaldi and his troops had welcomed the king and his army, and had taken the place assigned them in the rear, in a manner which no one had been able to criticize, and which had elicited the gratitude and praise of Della Rocca, the general most concerned. There was therefore not the smallest provocation for the official insult to which the whole body of Garibaldini were subjected on November 6th. On that day they had been instructed that the king would come to review them at Caserta. The dictator was to present his generals and his favorite officers to their sovereign, and the red shirts were to march past. Such a day might well have been a turning point in the life of the newborn nation. Old feuds, instead of taking on fresh and more virulent forms, would have been smoothed or healed. The Garibaldini assembled at Caserta with feelings of loyalty and pride. They were drawn up in front of the Bourbon Palace, in their picturesque regiments, good, bad, and indifferent, Sicilian and Calabrian, Northerner and Tuscan. They waited till after the appointed hour, and then learnt that the king had determined not to come. No apology or explanation was sent, or has ever since been offered. Further to point the moral, Victor Manuel did not even write an order of the day, thanking the men who had won for him the crown of the two Sicilies. Still less would Fanti, the commander-in-chief, put his name to such a document. It was signed by Della Rocca. The man who suffered most from the consequences of this ungracious conduct was the man who had vainly striven to avert the folly. It was against Cavour that Garibaldi turned his wrath. His personal devotion to Victor Emmanuel stood the shock. He persuaded himself that these acts of petty meanness had been specially ordered by the minister at Turin, though in fact they had been suggested either directly by Fanti or indirectly by the atmosphere of jealousy natural to a regular army in the presence of volunteers. This jealousy, common to every professional service in the world, and aggravated at Naples by the fact that these volunteers had really won their laurels, Cavour was unable to control from his cabinet in Turin. Next spring, in the first session of the first Parliament of United Italy, Garibaldi's pent-up wrath boiled over in a misdirected and malicious attack on the statesman who had been his guardian angel throughout the years of wonders. Garibaldi was sometimes unjust, but he seldom missed an occasion to be generous. And on the very afternoon of the thwarted review, he had a magnificent opportunity. General Cialdini arrived at Caserta, commissioned to obtain his promise to enter Naples on the following day in the same carriage with the king. It was very desirable that the dictator should appear at Victor Emmanuel's side, for if it became known that he had absented himself with a grievance, it was doubtful what sort of reception the royal party would obtain. There would indeed have been a fair case for him to refuse to enter Naples with the king, who had failed his appointment at the review. But he liked Cialdini well, and after some demur and a good deal of strong language against Fanti and Cavour, he finally consented to go. On November 7th, the first king of Italy entered his southern capital, with Garibaldi sitting beside him in the carriage. They were both out of temper, and it rained in torrents. But the Neapolitans were again in a state of frantic enthusiasm, which the rain could not damp, although it ruined the triumphal arches and caused the rows of pasteboard allegorical figures to double up as if they had been shot. If the king had been permitted to use common courtesy to the Garibaldian army in the matter of the review, and had shown more imaginative sympathy with men perhaps over-insensitive, little complaint could justly have been made of the treatment accorded to their material interests. In this matter, Victor Emmanuel was firm to see the right thing done, saying, "I cannot show less generosity than Garibaldi." It had been Cavour's original intention to divide the Garibaldini into three sections. The first, and far the largest, to be disbanded at once, with a gratuity for each man. The second to constitute a separate volunteer division of the army under the title of Cacciatori delle Alpi. The third to consist of a small number of officers to be given commissions in the regular army. But this plan was not carried out. It was decided not to constitute a permanent force of volunteers attached to the army, partly for fear of professional quarrels and political complications that might arise out of the existence of such a force, and partly because nearly all the genuine volunteers who had done the fighting were anxious to return at once to their families and to their work in life. The privates, therefore, were sent back each to his home with a gratuity. The Hungarians alone, who had no homes to which they could return, were taken into the royal service and were engaged for many years in the inglorious but dangerous task of tracking down the reactionary brigands of Molise and Abruzzi. There remained the questions of the officers. Since Cavour's scheme of a permanent volunteer force had been abandoned, it was felt to be only just that a very large number of Garibaldi's officers should be given posts in the regular army. A military commission, on which Sertori, Medici, and Cosenz had seats, chose out the officers most fit to be admitted into the king's service. It was a difficult task, for there were 6,000 or 7,000 so-called officers of all sorts drawing Garibaldi's pay in Sicily and on the mainland in the first days of November, about one officer to every 7 privates. Half or more of these must have been absolutely unworthy of permanent commissions. In the course of the next 2 years, 1,584 of the best men were picked out and admitted as officers to the regular army. Medici, Bixio, Cosenz, and 9 others were made generals. These arrangements were regarded with intense indignation by Garibaldi and his intimates at Caprera, who had expected that the volunteers would be kept in being as a permanent force, to form a nucleus for the national levée en masse in the coming war for Venice and Rome. But the settlement cannot, in a fair view of all the circumstances, be called either impolitic or unjust, although there were many individual cases of harsh treatment of men who had deserved well of their country. Although Victor Manuel was now in full possession of Naples, the half-formed kingdom of Italy was still in grave danger. On October 22nd, Cavour had felt the certainty that Austria will attack us. Every day that passed in safety added to the chances of peace and to the meager possibilities of resistance in case of war. But the emperors of Austria and Russia and the king of Prussia had met in conference at Warsaw, an ill-omened gathering of the murderers on the tomb of their victim, and Europe looked on to see whether they would decide to slay Italy as they had slain Poland. At this crisis, the Italian position was strengthened by the pronouncement of the British foreign minister in favor of the right of the Italians to settle their own affairs. Lord John's famous dispatch was his own spontaneous act, a personal proclamation of the principles of Charles James Fox, the gospel by which Russell's life had been inspired and guided. England, who had so often supported these principles and often opposed them, was in one of her generous moods and applauded to the echo of her champion's defiance of a despotic Europe. The first sentence plunges in medias res. It appears that the late proceedings of the King of Sardinia have been strongly disapproved by several of the principal courts of Europe. After telling some home truths about the character of the papal and Neapolitan governments, Lord John announces that Her Majesty's government must admit that the Italians are the best judges of their own interests. It is difficult, he proceeds, to believe, after the astonishing events that we have seen, that the Pope and the King of the Two Sicilies possess the love of their people. Therefore, Her Majesty's government can see no sufficient ground for the severe censure with which Austria, France, Prussia, and Russia have visited the acts of the King of Sardinia. Her Majesty's government will turn their eyes rather to the gratifying prospect of a people building up the edifice of their liberties and consolidating the work of their independence. This dispatch, written on October 27th and made public in the early days of November, was greeted with ecstasies of joy by the Italian people. Cavour, who had recently been somewhat annoyed by Lord John's insistent warning that Italy must not go to war to liberate Venice, declared that he had now more than made amends. Lord John's dispatch has sometimes been depreciated as a mere blowing of trumpets over the fait accompli of United Italy. But such was not the view of the men who best understood Italy's needs. Hudson wrote to Russell that when Cavour first read it, he shouted, rubbed his hands, jumped up and down again, and began to think, and when he looked up, tears were standing in his eyes. Behind your dispatch, he saw the Italy of his dreams, the Italy of his hopes, the Italy of his policy. Cavour himself wrote to thank Russell in the strongest language for the immense service he had rendered Italy. And his trusted agent, Villamarina, said the dispatch was worth an army of 100,000 men. The feeling of Cavour's countrymen for Lord John Russell was one of the chief instruments of their liberation, was shown in many different ways during the remainder of his life. Once, in 1869, when he and his family were staying in a villa at San Remo, they found the ceiling of the principal room frescoed with portraits of 4 national heroes. The 4 turned out to be Mazzini, Garibaldi, Cavour, and to their surprise and delight, Lord John himself. Neither had the house been specially prepared for the reception. It has, of recent years, been somewhat the fashion to blame Lord John Russell for his failures, but never to praise him for his triumphs. Fashions in history come and go, more often the reflexive tendencies in the present than the result of new knowledge of the past. It is probable that very few British statesmen in the course of their lives did as much to reinvigorate and secure the institutions of our country as was done by Russell in 1830 to 1832, or won for her as much well-deserved gratitude and such enduring friendship abroad as was secured by his action in 1859 and 1860. On the Italian question, England secured peace with true honor, and has ever since, either in point of interest or of conscience, had reason to repent of her work. On the day of their entrance into Naples, and on the following day, Victor Manuel and Garibaldi held private colloquies. The outgoing director asked to be continued in power for another year as the king's lieutenant, and to have the grade of all his officers recognized. Such requests showed how utterly incapable Garibaldi was of understanding the difficulties of administrative and military reorganization that confronted the new state. On November 8, the throne room in the palace was the scene of an imposing ceremony. The official presentation of the result of the plebiscite and the investiture of Victor Manuel with the kingship of Sicily and Naples. The new monarch was seated on his throne. Garibaldi and his friends stood in one group, the courtiers and army officers in another, and a small cordiality was shown between them. But the act of annexation was duly signed by all parties, and Garibaldi, formally resigning the dictatorship, left the room a private citizen once more. His first act in that capacity was to publish a letter calling on all Italians to rally round Victor Manuel and to be prepared to follow him next spring, a million strong, against Rome or Venice. By the side of the Re Galatuomo, he wrote, every quarrel should disappear, every rancor be dissipated. Garibaldi's public utterances during this period of strained relations were as loyal as if every demand he made had been conceded by the king. Before nightfall, he sent Missouri to tell the British admiral that he would leave for Caprera early the next morning, November 9th, and would come aboard the Hannibal to pay farewell visit before he quitted the bay. He spent the night in the Hotel d'Inghilterra in the Chiaja, talking with Missouri, Mario, Canzio, Zasio, and others of his intimate friends. As during all these last days, he was in a melancholy and gentle mood, moving his followers to tears when he spoke of their parting on the morrow. In spite of the brave words of the proclamation in which he thanked his soldiers and called on them to be ready against the next spring, all felt in their hearts the presentiment that their day of glory was at an end. And so these men, who had seized occasion by the forelock and had performed at the appointed moment the miracle never to be repeated, sat up all night in the hotel and talked sadly of what they had done and left undone. Next morning before dawn, they went down together to the port. The city was still asleep, and there was no one to witness the departure, which had been kept secret from everyone except the British admiral. They took a boat, rowed over to the Hannibal, and came up the side of the great three-decker, between the darkness and the first twilight. Admiral Mundy, still in his cot, was told that Garibaldi was in the cabin, and turned out with all haste to receive the strange man whom he had learnt to admire and love, while still keeping the open eye of common sense on his single-minded fanaticism. During a long talk in the cabin, Garibaldi invited Mundy to be his guest at his cottage at Caprera, and spoke much of the beautiful harbor between the island and the main, where Nelson had once anchored for the protection of his fleet. As they passed up from the cabin to the quarterdeck, Garibaldi saw the admiral's visiting book lying on the small table upon which, 6 months before at Palermo, he and the Bourbon generals had signed the armistice, the source of such mighty consequences. He sat down and wrote in the book in French. G. Garibaldi owes to Admiral Mundy the most lively gratitude, which will last all his life, on account of sincere proofs of friendship with which he has been loaded in all kinds of circumstances. As he went down the ship's side, many of the officers and crew of the Hannibal were deeply moved, and the expressions which some of them afterwards used about the look of intense love upon his face testify to the unique effect of his presence upon men trained in no sentimental school of thought or character. From the Hannibal he rode to the Washington, the steamer that was to take him home. On her deck he parted from Canseco, Missouri, Mario and his other friends, who returned to the quay. His last words to them were to meet again at Rome. Only his son, Menotti, and one or two persons of less importance sailed with him to the island. He returned thither as poor a man as he had left it in the spring. In the last 2 days Victor Manuel had offered him an estate for Menotti, the title of King's aide-de-camp for his younger son, a dowry for his daughter, a royal castle and a steamer for himself, but he had refused them all. His secretary, Basso, had borrowed a few hundred francs of paper money from a friend for necessary expenses. He himself had stowed on board the Washington a bag of seed corn for his farm. With these spoils, the steamer, almost unobserved, left port at break of day. He was soon back at his old daily occupation of man's primitive struggle with nature, at which, but for the call of a great epic and a great cause, he would so readily have spent his whole life. Again, the dawn and the twilight on the Straits of Bonifacio saw him at work among the granite boulders, industriously putting seed into the scrapings of earth which he called his fields, sheltering a few sad vines from the sweeping winds of the straits, calling up his cows by name from their pasturage among the wild, odorous brushwood, and seeking the strayed goats on the precipice top. Under these conditions, the melancholy of his last days on the mainland soon left him. When, a few weeks later, a visitor came on business from Genoa, he found Garibaldi robust in health and radiant with a calm and serene joy. For when once he had been left alone again with his mother earth between rock and sea and sky, no disappointment could prevent him from feeling in his heart the truth that he had done a mighty labor and taken his share in a task which the years would soon complete and the long generations ratify, the making of Italy. End of chapter 15.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.